Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, February 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a U.S. appeals court promises a ruling as soon as possible on the Trump travel ban.
If the order said Muslims cannot be admitted, would anybody have standing to challenge that?
A war of words between the U.S. and Iran. Despite an all-night protest by Democrats, the president's education secretary wins nomination. Also ahead in entertainment news.
If you're not the one for me.
We are talking all things Adele. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, a U.S. federal appeals court heard oral arguments on Tuesday in the legal battle over President Donald Trump's executive order temporarily suspending the country's refugee admissions program and banning entry to people from seven Muslim-majority nations for 90 days. Now, speaking to the National Association of Sheriffs at the White House earlier in the day, the president had this to say about his order.
It's common sense. You know, some things are law, and I'm all in favor of that. And some things are common sense. This is common sense.
A hearing before the San Francisco-based Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges was the greatest legal challenge yet to the ban, which has upended travel to the U.S. for more than a week and tested the new administration's use of executive power. A Justice Department lawyer asked the court to restore Trump's order, contending that the president alone has the power to decide who can enter or stay in the U.S.
And the president's determination that a 90-day pause was needed for the seven countries at issue here in order to ensure adequate standards, and that's language from the order, for visa screening was plainly constitutional.
Well, the final minutes of the hearing were largely devoted to whether the travel ban was intended to discriminate against Muslims. Judge Richard Clifton wanted to know how the order could be considered discriminatory if it potentially affected only 15% of the world's Muslims, according to his calculations. In response, Washington State Solicitor General Noah Purcell cited Trump's campaign statements about a Muslim ban and public statements by advisor Rudy Giuliani.
We're not saying that this is a complete ban on Muslims entering the country. Obviously, I mean, they realize what his advisor said on television was that he was asked for a way to implement a narrower thing that would be legal, but the point is that was clearly a motivating what we have alleged. And again, we do have to show a likelihood of success, but at this stage the case law is clear. Our plausible allegations are taken as true.
Well, if the case does end up before the U.S. Supreme Court, it could prove difficult to find the necessary 5 votes to undo a lower court order. The 9-justice high court has been at less than full strength since Justice Antonin Scalia's death a year ago. How and when a case might get to the Supreme Court is unclear. The travel ban itself is set to expire in 90 days, meaning it could run its course before a higher court takes up the issue, or the administration could change it in any number of ways that would keep the issue alive. The White House has dismissed a defiant message from Iran's supreme leader about Donald Trump saying Ayatollah Ali Khamenei should realize there is a new president in office. In his daily briefing to Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said Trump will not sit by and let Iran flaunt violations or apparent violations of its 2015 nuclear deal with the U.S. and 5 world powers.
I think the president or the Ayatollah is going to realize that there is a new president in office. This president's not going to sit by and let Iran flout its violations or its apparent violations to the joint agreement. But he will continue to take action as he sees fit. The president's also made clear time and time again that he's not going to project what those actions will be, and he will not take anything off the table. But I think Iran is kidding itself if they don't realize that there is a new president in town.
Well, Spicer was responding to a question about Khamenei, who earlier in the day made his first public remarks about Trump since the president took office. According to Khamenei's website, he spoke to a gathering of military commanders in Tehran about Trump's recent warning that Iran is, quote, on notice for carrying out a January 29th missile test that Washington said undermined regional security and put American lives at risk. He said, quote, Trump says, you should be afraid of me. No. The Iranian people will respond to words on February 10th and will show their stance against such threats, Khamenei said. Iran marks the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution on that date. Well, a UN Security Council resolution underpinning the Iran nuclear deal urges Tehran to refrain from testing missiles designed to be able to carry nuclear warheads, but imposes no obligation. Khamenei also used his speech to thank Trump for exposing what he called the real face of America. Joining me now to discuss, Professor Amin Saikal, Director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us, Professor.
President Trump had promised during his campaign that he will try to undo Iran's nuclear agreement with the world powers, and he has branded Iran as the main source of support for international terrorism, and therefore Iran is liable to be punished. And of course, he's been very much encouraged by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's always said that nuclear deal was a really bad one, and it was going to cause more problems rather than really solving problems. And I think as long as President Trump remains firm on his rhetoric on this issue, the Iranians will react very sharply. In fact, the Iranian foreign minister has made it clear that there is a snapback clause in the agreement that if Iran violates it, the United States will put the sanctions back on Iran. And if the United States violates it, then Iran could return its nuclear program to its normal stage, which the normal stage basically means reinstating the 20,000 centrifuges and accelerating the production of enriched uranium, which in turn will probably anger the United States. But then again, let's not forget that the nuclear agreement has not been just between Iran and the United States, but rather between Iran and the world powers. This is a fight. Permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. And the other signatories to the agreement have made it very clear that they're going to honor their commitment.
Were relations starting to improve between the U.S. and Iran under the Obama administration, or was that all just a facade?
No, there was a thaw. Definitely, and the relationship. And of course, for the first time since the Iranian Revolution of 1978-79, Iranian president spoke directly with American president and vice versa. And also, there was face-to-face meetings over a long period of time between the American Secretary of State, John Kerry, and the Iranian Foreign Minister, Javad Zarif. Those meetings were very crucial in terms of finally producing the nuclear agreement. Neither side had really expected that signing of the agreement necessarily going to lead to the restoration of diplomatic relations between the two sides in the near future. But at the same time, I think there were hope. Thaw in the relationship would lead to some sort of rapprochement between the two sides.
How is this new tougher stance that this new administration is trying to portray to the world, how is that being received in the Middle East?
A lot of concern and also a lot of dismay. Iranians' expectations were that the nuclear deal will be honored by the United States. In the meantime, the Arab countries are also very much concerned, and the Palestinians are terribly concerned because President Trump's policy statements have given a lot of encouragement to the right-wing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to not only announce construction of more housings on the occupied territories, particularly in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, but also they've just passed a bill which the Attorney General of Israel declared it as unconstitutional to legalize the settlements that Israel has already established in the occupied territories. So it's a major source of concern for the Palestinians. And of course, those countries, including America's allies, which have called for a peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on a two-state solution. And of course, everybody will be really watching the forthcoming visit of Prime Minister Netanyahu to Washington.
The world is watching what has been happening with the president's travel ban. You're in Australia. You specialize in Middle East studies. What are people on the other side of the world from the U.S. saying? How are they reacting? Is there mixed reaction?
Well, you always have a number of conservative groups in Western democracies, and that includes Australia, that would be really supporting the policies that President Trump has wished to pursue. But at the same time, I think a majority of the public remain very highly skeptical and highly critical of the policies that so far have been pursued. And I think there's a sort of some fundamental contradictions that people have discerned in President Trump's approach. I mean, on the one hand, he's blacklisted something like 7 countries, or Muslim-majority countries, from where immigrants are not allowed to come, at least for the next 3 months, to the United States, notwithstanding the current lifting of the ban by the judiciary. He has not really targeted the countries from where some of the terrorist attacks in the United States have originated. I mean, some people have really pointed out, for example, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Egypt, and so on, and they have not been really targeted. And also, I must really point out that between 1975 and 2015, not a single American has been killed as a result of terrorist actions by any citizen of the countries which President Trump has blacklisted.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective, Professor Amin Saikal, Director at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Army to allow completion of the Dakota Access oil pipeline. The wife says is gravely ill. Putin critic was poisoned. China waits as President Trump speaks with world leaders. From disputes to a breakup, wounds are still raw after the U.S. election. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the Vice President votes in the affirmative and the nomination is confirmed.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has sworn in Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education after he cast a tie-breaking Senate vote Tuesday to confirm President Trump's controversial nominee. It was the first time in American history that a vice president has been needed to get a cabinet pick approved. Earlier in the day, two Senate Republicans voted with a United Democratic caucus in opposition to DeVos, a champion of allowing families to use public school funds to send their children to private schools. The result was a 50-50 split before Pence cast his deciding vote, as the Constitution provides. Here's Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
I think you could have a great Secretary of Education who hadn't attended public schools, who had come from private schools and had good, you know, private school examples to learn from. I think that's fine. But if you've never attended public school for a day, if your children have never attended for a day, if you've never taught at a public school, I kind of have the attitude, what gives you the right to just stand up and say, public schools are a dead end?
A wealthy businesswoman, DeVos has never been a teacher or a school administrator. During her Senate confirmation hearing, she said that guns might be needed at some remote schools to ward off grizzly bears, prompting expressions of disbelief and scorn from Democrats. Well, turning now to what's been trending on social media, we are joined by VOA's David Byrd, who is in for G. Abby Lee. Hi, David. What's happening?
The biggest subject trending on Twitter today is, of course, the confirmation of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Vice President Mike Pence broke a 50-50 tie by casting a vote in favor of Ms. DeVos.
First time ever, right?
First time in the history of the United States that the vice president has had to break a senatorial tie for a cabinet member. That obviously generated a lot of heat and a lot of light on Twitter. Seth MacFarlane, you might know him, comedian, was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner a couple of years ago, said Betsy DeVos confirmed. What's also confirmed is that there is not one single man of courage in the Republican Congress. Senator Cory Booker, who's from New Jersey, said to all of those who are angry or frustrated about today's vote confirming DeVos, please know the vote may be over, but our fight must continue. He's a Democratic senator. Deplorable Melissa at Sweet Tater Tot 2 said, I hope you lefties realize all your little temper tantrums. The crying, the rioting, destroying property is doing nothing for you. And the president, Donald Trump, at POTUS, said, congratulations to our new education secretary at Betsy DeVos, exclamation point. Okay. The other big thing trending is the San Remo Music Festival. Now, are you familiar with this?
No, I'm not, actually.
It's a singing competition.
Okay.
And this one is in San Remo, Italy. It's taking place in the Teatro Ariston, forgive me if I mispronounce that, but Carlo Conti, Ivana Sabatini, Leopoldo Siano, Emanuele Giovannini, and others are responsible for this. There's a voting, and it's kind of complicated. There's five evenings of competition. There's the public televoting, which is carried out by landline or mobile phone app and or online voting. Then there's a press jury, which is the journalists at the actual competition. Then there's what's called a demoscopic poll, which is composed of 300 music fans, which vote from their homes via an electronic voting system. There's an expert jury from the music business, and the winner is determined by a combination of the public televote, the expert jury, and the demoscopic poll. Now, basically, there's several categories, big artists, newcomers, etc. The final is on Saturday. As far as Instagram, big thing trending, Christy Brinkley. You remember
yes,
Christy Brinkley, supermodel?
Of course, of course.
Ex-wife of singer Billy Joel.
Mm-hmm.
She is going to be in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Coming out next week. She's 63.
That's fantastic.
And as a red-blooded American male, mm-hmm, I can say she looks really good for
really?
63. Yes, she does.
So we can already see the photo, I take it.
It's on Instagram.
Okay.
If you go to her Instagram feed, you can see it. Sports Illustrated doesn't want too much coming out before the issue because then people won't buy the magazine. But she's posing with her daughters, Sailor, who's only 18, and Alexa, who's her daughter with Billy Joel. Quite an attractive woman for 63. She's a trending topic on Instagram. So that's what the social world's been up to today.
All right, David, thanks so much. You can follow him, by the way, on Twitter at David_DBird, B-Y-R-D. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in many parts of America, everyday routines require a car. Everything, going to work, taking children to activities or doctors, running errands, always takes longer without a car. And sometimes not having wheels can even lead to job loss. As VOA's Carol Pearson tells us, One Car Award program is working to make sure that doesn't happen.
We are very excited to have you.
LaTanya Pierce has been waiting for this moment for years. The mother of seven children is finally getting a car.
Thank you. That's all I can say is thank you. Thank you, Lord. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was hard. I was, like, taking the bus. I was catching sedans, taxis, getting my family cars. It was just struggling. That's all. It's a big struggle for me. So this, having this, it's a blessing.
The blessing came through Vehicles for Change, a nonprofit organization that sells cars to low-income families at a minimal cost.
So it's important that you keep an eye on everything.
Okay.
Martin Schwartz founded the organization, based outside of Baltimore, Maryland in 1999.
And we take donated cars, mostly from the general public. The ones that are in decent condition, we repair. And then we identify families who need a car to get to and from employment to escape poverty.
The recipients pay about $900 for the car with a 12-month loan.
So they establish credit while they're paying for their car, which is very valuable for them as they get on their feet and look to buy a house or get a credit card or all those kind of things. This has given them an opportunity to establish credit as well as owning a vehicle.
The program works closely with local social service agencies.
In order to get a car from our program, you have to be recommended by a partner agency. So we work with homeless shelters, and we work with job training programs, and we work with domestic violence shelters, and they identify the people who need a car, and then we provide the vehicle.
Congratulations.
Since its launch, Vehicles for Change has awarded 5,700 cars to low-income families. The group's study found that 75% of recipients got better jobs or boosted their earnings by an average of $7,000 within the first year. Pierce, a nursing assistant, expects owning a car will make a big difference in her life.
With my job, I was stuck at a facility. So now if I do private duty, I can get more hours and I can make more money. And I can do different things with my kids, like stay out later. We can go a lot of places that they always wanted to go and enjoy ourselves.
Schwartz hopes to expand the program across the country with a lofty goal of helping as many people as possible climb out of poverty from behind the wheel of their own car. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Well, British singer Adele getting a lot of attention these days. Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with more.
Adele was originally approached to perform the halftime show at the Super Bowl, which was performed by Lady Gaga on Sunday night. And she turned it down because she said the halftime show at the Super Bowl is not about music. She said it's more of a show. And if you've ever seen Adele, she said it's not really a show that I do. I sing songs. I'm a singer. And that's kind of where she's from. She said I don't dance. Mm-hmm. I don't have special effects. That's just not my thing. So she didn't think she'd be the proper choice for the Super Bowl halftime show. So she told the NFL, no, thank you. But she did send out a tweet and said, Lady Gaga, you smashed it, totally nailed it. So apparently she approved of Lady Gaga's performance during the Super Bowl show. Now, other things about Adele. She is going to be performing at the Grammys this coming up Sunday. She was at last year's Grammys. And, of course, she's nominated for a handful of Grammys because of her recent album 25, which is her third album. And I guess it's sold over 10 million copies. So once you hit the 10 million sales mark, they kind of stop counting. Been on the charts an amazing 63 weeks. Right now, her album 25 is at number 23 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. And she is currently on tour and will continue touring. Apparently, according to the Grammys, she is the highest paid act at the Grammys on tour. $80.5 million. $80.5 million is what she made in 2016. And she averages about $3.8 million per city on her tour, in addition to the album sales. So Adele is doing well enough to turn down $50 million in endorsement deals. She's been offered commercials and endorsements, and she said, no, I'm not going to do that. Why? Not that she's got enough money, but she's going to do it because she wants to be a mom. And she said, I want to protect my relationship with my children. I want to spend time with my kids. I don't want to be recording TV commercials all the time. So she's got a four-year-old son whose name is Angelo. On a recent tour stop, she told the audience she wants to have a second child as soon as the tour, you know, finishes. But today we're going to listen to the latest single from Adele. And this is the fourth song from the album 25. This one's called Water Under the Bridge.
If you're not the one for me.
I'd also read that Adele has purchased a home in the Hollywood Hills.
She's got homes everywhere. When you make $80.5 million a year, you can have a home wherever you want to have a home. And, you know, she was spotted a couple weeks ago grocery shopping by herself. She didn't have the makeup on. She just went out and said, thought she'd be just a regular person and just go grocery shopping. So, of course, the paparazzi found her and took photos of her, but she looked like any. You probably would walk past her down the produce aisle and you'd never know that's Adele. So, yeah, she wants to lead as regular a life as she can, given that she's a superstar known around the world. But, yeah, I mean, she's got a house in Beverly Hills. She lives in the United States. She also has homes back in England, where she's originally from. She leads a very simple life. She drives, one of the cars she has is a Cooper, a Mini Cooper. She drives a little car, so she's not into big. She's not into being picked up by limos and driving Porsches and Jaguars. She just kind of keeps it simple, which is very nice, and she just wants to live that kind of a lifestyle and stay grounded. We'll see her on the Grammy show. She's up against a lot of different performers for the biggest award of the day, the Album of the Year, which is a title she won at last year's Brit Award show, the Album of the Year for 25. She also last year got the Brit Award for the Song of the Year for Hello. She's nominated for a handful. She'll be up against Beyonce at this year's Grammys on Sunday night. So we shall see. Will it be Adele? Will it be Beyonce? Who will it be? We'll find out.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing. If you're gonna let me down gently. Don't pretend that you don't.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the recent spike in violence in eastern Ukraine around Avdiivka. Since January 28th, the Special Monitoring Mission of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, has reported a dramatic increase in fighting in eastern Ukraine, including attacks with weapons banned by the Minsk agreements, signed in 2014 and 2015. The fighting has caused dozens of Ukrainian military casualties and at least 50 civilian casualties. It has also left approximately 17,000 civilians, including 2,500 children, without water, heat, or electricity. The UN Security Council expressed its grave concern over the dangerous deterioration in eastern Ukraine and called for an immediate return to a ceasefire regime. Security Council members also expressed their full support of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. Nearly 10,000 people, more than half of them civilians, have been killed in Ukraine since the fighting erupted in the spring of 2014, when the Russian military moved to occupy Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea was preceded by months of pro-Western protests in Ukraine's capital of Kiev, which ultimately prompted Ukraine's pro-Russian president to abandon his position and flee the country. In response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine, the United States, the EU, and a number of other countries applied targeted sanctions against Russian individuals, businesses, and officials. These sanctions remain in effect nearly 3 years later. To avert a larger humanitarian crisis, the United States calls for an immediate, sustained ceasefire and full and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. The U.S. also reaffirms its support for full implementation of the Minsk agreements to end the violence in eastern Ukraine and calls for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.